Hi, my name's TJ Myhill. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta. I work with a variety of video game, video game companies at all levels of the industry, from startups and students to larger companies. I'm on the board of the Georgia Game Developers Association and worked in video games for probably about 12 years now. I'm here to speak about the legal issues, and then to discuss the practical and business issues. We have people who actually know what the hell they're talking about, because I don't. So
who?
I'll let them introduce themselves.
Who's this? Oh, Alanka.
Alanka, right.
I'm just the guy sitting in the middle. My name is Brian Green, also known online as PsychoChild. I helped write a business a book on business and legal issues in the games industry. And for mobile games, my previous job was with a company called Storybricks, doing a lot of advanced AI stuff, primarily on, looking at the MMO market, which is where, most of my experience is with. But we were also investigating mobile games and looking at, kind of the business side of that.
Hi, my name's Ilanka Dunan. I've been making games for 25 years now. So got involved with mobile games pretty much when it started. If you have iOS games or if you have an iPhone with you, I've got Tiny Heroes and One Epic Night. If you've got Android, I've got One Epic Night. I got other stuff in the works. I'm a lifetime member of the International Game Developers Association and co-founded the Online Games Special Interest Group back when online games were, it's just a fad. I'm currently studio director at Blackgate Games in Nashville and happy to share any knowledge I've got.
All right. I tend to think these work best as a conversation type panel. So, we're happy to sit up here and jabber at you for a while and get questions started, but feel free to ask questions as you come up with them. But remember, you need to talk into the funny orange box in order to actually for us to hear you and for the video to hear you. So let's get the conversation started about, what are some of the practical issues for creating a mobile game?
And I'd also kind of like to get a sense of the audience here. Has anyone here ever made not just a mobile game, but even a mobile app of any kind? Okay. How about mobile games in particular? Okay. Of the mobile apps, how many of you made an iOS app? And how many of you made an Android app? You have my sympathies. Okay. And so if any of you want to jump in and share your own knowledge or horror stories, feel free to jump in. Yeah. Okay. So what was the first question?
What are some of the practical aspects when you're going to think about creating a mobile game? What are the first thing you want to decide between iOS and Android? What are the practical startup type questions you might ask?
And I would say the first question is, are you doing this by yourself or are you doing it with other people? And so, if you're working with other people, I would say the first mistake that people will often make is to go to the store and upload it on their personal account, rather than have some sort of a legal entity involved, right? A lot of heads nodding here. So in creating that legal entity, you've got all kinds of things you can do. You can do an LLC, you can do a corporation, S-Corp, C-Corp. What do people recommend? If you're just starting out, you've never created a company before, what's the best kind of company to make?
That a question for me?
Sure, or anybody.
Yeah. I think, again, fundamentally, you really want to, this is the kind of question you want to ask before you even start writing a line of code. Mm-hmm. The big thing you want to look at is, this concept of limited liability. If something goes horribly, horribly wrong, you don't want your personal bank account, savings, house, family savings to be on the line. You want somebody to be able to sue the company, and you want to do everything properly to make sure that the company basically takes the brunt of whatever goes wrong. And exactly what Alanka said too, if you've got multiple people, you don't want to be paying for somebody else's mistakes. If they screw up and they cause harm to the company, again, you don't want it to come back to you. When you start out, Alanka's exactly right. You don't want, because you can be best friends. You can be childhood friends. Everything's fine. You're like, everybody's happy. But when there's that problem and it becomes messy and emotional, you do not want to be in a situation where you do not have a legal agreement in place that basically says this is exactly what happens, you know, when we want to essentially end the partnership.
One of the biggest things people run into in that, creating an LLC or a corporation, LLCs are much easier.
I would recommend an LLC. Lowest barrier for somebody new to get in.
Absolutely. Unless you're planning to go public anytime soon or you really have some other reason to be a corporation, an LLC is very satisfactory for a small startup and even most large businesses. But in addition to the corporate formation, so that you have that corporate shield, that limitation of your own liability, the important thing to do is not just create the corporation, but to create all the documents that go along with it. The operating agreement, the bylaws, the shareholder agreements, the copyright agreements, the understanding of how this is going to work. Because unless you are going to sit home by yourself in your own living room and create every single element of your game, you're going to get screwed somewhere along the line if you don't have stuff on paper, because you don't have an ownership interest in everything that you don't create unless you have it on paper. You don't have rights to use things you don't create unless you have it on paper. And you don't have an understanding of how we're going to split up the profits or the problems unless you have it on paper. And I can guarantee you that you can come to me and spend a couple $100 and get some really nice documents drafted up, or you can come to me and spend tens of thousands of dollars to figure out the problem when it comes up. So
better to spend a couple $100 up front. Also, I would say, even if you're working with your best friend that you've known since you were 5 years old and you agree on everything, it's when you create the organization, I would say don't make it a 50-50 mm-hmm. corporation. Make it a 51-49. Just so when you come into that where you're talking and you cannot agree, that it's clear who's got the final say.
Right.
51-49 is definitely the way to go.
Right, absolutely. I completely agree with that. Yeah, that was basically a mistake I made with one of my first companies, is 50-50, and then I essentially had a partner, you know, he basically lost interest in it, you know, and so it was like, yeah, but he still, you know. So the context is basically I bought a game that, you know, we had both worked on before, and then we were running it as a separate company. We acquired it from the original owner, and so he wasn't really interested in the day-to-day stuff, but he also wasn't interested in, you know, doing anything risky with it. And so essentially we were just deadlocked for, you know, quite a while, where, you know, we were maintaining the game, but I didn't feel like I could take the steps I needed in order to grow the company. And so, you know, yeah, having, you know, so, you know, if I had been the 49%, then I would have known, you know, okay, you know, he's calling the shots, you know, I have to go, you know, maybe it's time to look for other opportunities. But
and if you can't agree at the very beginning who should have the 51 and who should have the 49, figure that out at the very beginning,
right,
that you
right.
can't agree on something as basic as that. It's a really good litmus test for how well you're going to do when faced with the really tough decisions later.
Precisely.
Okay. Question in the back. Can we throw her the box?
Yes. Sure. Y'all mentioned earlier that when you set up email accounts with the Play Store or the Apple Store, it's possible if you get banned, even if it's not for a legitimate reason, that you could also lose your personal Gmail by getting banned from the Play Store. So even if you have a separate account, you don't want to attach email to that account.
Right.
That you...
Yeah, once you create a company, it's super easy to have a company domain name that you use for the official email addresses that you're using to go on the Apple Store, go on the Google Play Store, and that way if you do run into any trouble, and like you said, you can run into trouble for no fault of your own, some kinds of issues. So keep your personal stuff separate as much as possible. Good point.
Well, and from a legal perspective, you do have to keep your personal stuff separate. I mean, one of the things that people, again, small companies run into a lot is that people don't think of the company as separate from themselves. And it's critical that you do think of the company as separate from yourself, because if you treat the company like your regular bank account, well, then the corporate protection actually goes away. And when I come along and sue you, I do go get your personal bank account, which defeats the entire purpose of going through all this effort to begin with. So run your company like a company. Set it up, set it aside. It's its own legal entity, and run it as such.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I did is, you know, my significant other, you know, I let her take care of our personal finances. I took care of the corporate finances, and never the twain shall meet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just kept that, you know, separate people doing the separate finances. That way there's no possibility of intermingling.
Another issue, once you have an entity, is you're going to want to have certain basic legal documents. And you don't have to hire an attorney to make them. There's a lot of boilerplate that's out there, not trying to take business from legal profession. But you're going to want to have some sort of some bylaws for your company and create an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, so that anyone you do business with is required to sign this NDA. NDAs are very difficult to enforce, especially if there's some sort of non-compete. So you may not ever want to enforce it, but having it and having that agreement where someone is signing it, it just adds that level of formality to the agreement that...
Yeah. It makes people think twice before right. they do disclose. It's not necessarily going to stop anyone from disclosing, and the enforceability, whether it's enforceable or not, can't call that knowledge back. But what you end up with is something that dissuades people from mm-hmm. talking about things because, oh, I've signed a contract, so I shouldn't do that. So right. if I'm an upright person, I'm not going to do that.
Mm-hmm. And keep in mind, too, I mean, there's going to be some situations where an NDA isn't applicable. If you're going out and looking for outside investment, you know, investors are going to laugh at you if you say, hey, I need you to sign this NDA before I tell you about this. You know, just kind of accept that, you know, your business plan kind of gets out there and it'll probably be passed to other investors. But, you know, you never know. That might be a good thing. Somebody else might say, hey, this is a brilliant idea. So, you know, use common sense. And kind of as a larger issue, I would say, you know, like, you don't necessarily need a lawyer, but get to know a lawyer. You know, and I think this is very important. I mean, this is like a big thing for just business in general. It's like, you know, making contacts and basically, you know, especially people that have been there before, you know, find a mentor. That helps a whole lot because there's going to be, mm-hmm. you know, if you're going out alone, again, you know, voice experience here, mm-hmm. you know, you're going out alone, there's a lot of stuff that you may not think about. You know, a lawyer or an accountant or, you know, somebody that's done this before can help you through. And, you know, it's not even necessarily, you know, complex stuff. It's just like something you may not have thought about off the top mm-hmm. of your head. So yeah.
Having a circle of advisors is a great, great way to proceed. And it could be an elderly relative that you know, or maybe a younger relative that you know, and just look around, and there will be people out there. There's a SCORE, I think, is still active, mm-hmm. the Service Corps of Retired Executives, and these are people who have a ton of business experience, and they just love giving advice to startups for free, and so just look up, find what the local SCORE chapter is in your area. I know several people that have experience from the World Bank, from you know, different large Fortune 500 companies, and just expand that circle and just, you know, call them up once a month or once a quarter and say, you know, hey, can I talk to you about what's going on? And usually they'll be delighted to share their advice and experience, and, you know, and especially retirees, because they've got the time. And people that are in a company may be delighted to share their experience, but it's much more difficult to get their time. So you mm-hmm. might want to schedule a lunch or something and maybe pick up the tab on a lunch, and then you're more likely to kind of get their uninterrupted attention. With some people, I've had to say, put down your phone, put down your computer. I want just you. And sometimes you have to be aggressive about that. But yeah, talk to other people. If you're creating a small game company, look for someone else that you respect that has created a small company that is successful. Or even if they're not successful, you can get a lot of learning experiences mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, sometimes failure is a better teacher than success sometimes even. Yeah. So. Yeah.
And joining the IGDA, the International Game Developers Association, is a great way to do it because it gives you those contacts. You can find a company, and I did this when we founded the studio. I identified four or five other people I knew in the IGDA who had founded studios, and I just sent them an email saying, I'm where you were 2 years ago. Can I talk to you? Yep. Every single one said yes. And, you know, we had a call, and they said, make sure you pay attention to the budget, make sure you pay attention to the organization. And they, I just benefit a lot from their experience. And I still call them. I still want to stay.
Yeah, one of the chapters of the book that I wrote, we called it I Wish I Knew. And that was probably the most, you know, the most useful and the most timeless part of the book. You know, it's just basically asking people, like, hey, when you were starting out, what did you know, what advice would you give other people? Right. What do you wish you knew back then? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and people love sharing that type of information too.
And it's not really hard to find. I mean, like Alonka said, I'm also a member of the IGDA. That group is a great resource for contacts, for information. Georgia Game Developers Association, one of the things we try to do is have, you know, monthly meetings where there's some networking and you can mm-hmm. get together and meet people. Find a local organization or a local chapter of IGDA or something like that that has a same sort of meetup or networking event, whether it's once a month or once a quarter or once a year. It still gives you people to have, you know, in your Rolodex, if anyone has those anymore. And call on when you have these questions.
Yeah. Check meetup.com. There's probably local game developer groups at meetup.com. Also look for game jams in your area where people get together in 48 hours and make games. And especially if you've got mobile experience, you're going to be really popular at a game jam. I've seen people show up at a jam. Their resume is completely empty, but they can go to a 48-hour jam, get the theme on Friday, create a game in 48 hours, get it on the Google Play Store, and it's shipping to customers within 48 hours. I mean, that's an amazing skill set to have. And even if you can't do it, you can go to a jam, you find somebody else that does it. That's the kind of person you want to identify to maybe be involved with your company.
Yeah, just a couple other suggestions. I teach entrepreneurship, so I would suggest just generally find your local college or university. There's somebody there that probably teaches entrepreneurship, can give you advice, but also we network quite a lot with people in all kinds of industries, so good person to get to know. We're generally happy to give advice. I mean, that's just what we do for a living. Many universities also have a center, and so they work in connecting people and helping people get businesses started. And then, of course, there are incubators that usually workshops and stuff like that. So one in Charleston, they have every Friday they do something. And so that's another good thing to do.
Yeah, those workshops are valuable. Nashville definitely has an entrepreneur center, and they'll often have free workshops, or they'll have some sort of a program that you can get involved with where they'll walk you through. And another advantage to getting involved with these entrepreneur groups, I mean, that was a great point, is it may also put you in touch with VC, venture capitalists.
Yep.
And that's a whole nother topic that I don't know if we're quite ready for it, but the whole idea of funding is definitely something that any new company is going to be interested in.
Well, and follow up on that too. One of the things, I was in school for over 10 years. I wish I knew I had an entrepreneur program, because I wouldn't have had to figure out so much stuff out on my own. One of the things to understand is that your contacts don't have to be a mobile game developer or even a game developer. A guy who started up a fried chicken shack knows an awful lot about starting a business. And the things he screwed up are things you're also going to screw up. The fact that he makes fried chicken and you make a video game doesn't enter into the equation of how did I screw up my LLC, how did I screw up my bank account, how did I screw up my licensing, how did my partner take all my money. Those kinds of things happen in every business. So figuring out what not to do is universal.
What are some of the horror stories that you've heard about getting games on the pull down or banned or taken out? I mean, how have you... I'm sure there's that terrible story that everybody passes along in that community. Do you know any of those?
Well, it sounds like we might have a horror story here with the witch or wizard. I can't tell.
It's a pointy hat one way or the other.
Okay. Very impressive beard.
I haven't had that happen, but I've known people who've had a game banned and suddenly they can't get in their Gmail, so they have no backup documentation to say,
"Oh, ouch.
Maybe we're right." And that's definitely a possibility.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you one of the things that comes and bites people that talk to me all the time. I don't get involved with your game's banned. You've been removed from the store. If you're removed from the store, then shit, I'm going to be able to do about it. So no one comes to see me about that. But what people come to see me about are things that they screwed up that's causing them problems otherwise. Two of the biggest ones are work-for-hire agreements and open-source software. Mm-hmm. And the two biggest things that people have problems with as small startups or people working with other contractors trying to get this guy to create something for them is you've got to have good documentation. You have to have a work for hire document, which is a contract that says, Brian, I'm going to hire you to write some code for me, and I would like you to create this code for my game, and when you're done with it, I'm going to pay you some money and we're all going to be happy.
And this is how long it's going to take.
Right. And the problem is that if I don't do that, Brian writes me some code and I pay him some money, but at the end of the day, Brian still owns the code. Brian's the copyright owner. And when Brian decides I didn't pay him enough money, or he gets pissed off at me, or he thinks I'm using it inappropriately, or something else goes wrong, he can control my game. He can take all of these elements that he created. Even if I created half of it, he created half of it. Can I separate his half out and still sell mine? these are issues that come up because I didn't get the ownership. I didn't get a contract, either a work for hire contract with a contractor or, you know, a broad assignment with my partners or anything else that you need to make sure that you understand who owns everything that goes into the game. And then the other problem we run into is what goes into the game, because we have a real issue. It seems to be there's almost a mental disconnect at the two levels of game. There's the gaming company who really wants to have a very legal, controlling ownership type of understanding of copyright. And then there's the guys who write code, who like to share and be open and be very friendly, and copyright be damned. And the problem is that that works great down here and this works great up here, but when you put these two things together, it doesn't really always mesh. And what you run into is people who do share code. Who owns that? You use open source code. Who owns that? Well, everybody now, because you put open source code in there and there can be a, you know, reciprocal license that means everybody can use that. Now your game is not copyrightable. So we run into things like that all the time. People are not thinking through the process of creating the content and how to make sure that they can own and control the content, because that's the only way you're going to be a successful game company, is to be able to control your content.
I think one horror story I'd say is probably just a general category of cash flow. You know, sometimes, you know, things are beyond your control. Like, you know, you have to submit your game to the store. You know, what if they reject it the first time? What if they reject it a couple times? And it takes a week every time you submit it. If you need cash flow this month in order to pay rent or whatever, and, you know, the app store is rejecting your game every time, that can be very uncomfortable. You know, it's better to plan for that ahead of time if you can.
Hi, I know we've talked a lot about, I guess, protections, legal protections created by documents, but of course, that doesn't exist in a vacuum. If something goes wrong, you have to take actions to enforce that. So I'm curious about if you've ever had to follow up on those contracts to pursue someone, whether you had to do a cost-benefit analysis of how much that was going to cost you to pursue it in court, and is it something you can pursue in, like, small claims court or just the peace or something like that, where it's something you can actually afford to do when you're thinking about things like paying your rent?
Right. And it really depends on the case of what you're doing. Like, I had an issue where I did contract work for a company that didn't pay me for that contract work. So something else to bring up is, like, you, TJ, hires me to do contract work. We have great legal agreements because he's an attorney, saying that what I do belongs to him, but he doesn't pay me. That means the contract is violated. I own the work. He doesn't own it anymore until he pays me. So I can now sell it to somebody else. So that's one issue. Another would be if he didn't pay me for, let's say, $50,000, and then I want to go after him for that $50,000. I have the contract. I go to a collections attorney, and I've done, not with TJ, but I've done this with someone else. The general rule is 20%. It's going to cost me, with an attorney who's going to go after him to get my money, and then the attorney's going to want 20% of whatever it is. So I might go to him and say, hey, you owe me $50,000. Let's knock 20% off of it. You know, just pay me the 80%, and that way I don't have to go get an attorney. So that's one cost benefit. Another might be, and this is another one that I've seen, where there's an issue intellectual property and what's going on here, and it might be a case of it's going to cost $35,000 to pursue the contract. So you do have to think about, okay, I'll pay $35,000. What's it going to be worth to me in order to win this case? Well, I win the case and I get $50,000. So do I really want to pay $35,000 to get that $15,000 along with all the pain and agony and, you know, emotional anguish? And for that, it's going to be a personal decision. You know, like, damn it, they screwed me over. I want them to pay me, and I'm going to pay the $35,000, and it's going to be $15,000 profit at the end. And others are going to say, no, I got other things to do. So it's a personal decision.
Yeah, definitely keep your good mind you the time you're going to spend, because you know if you're litigating something, you're going to an attorney to litigate something, it's going to be a giant time suck. And if you're already on thin margins, you know, yeah, you might, that, you know, that calculus might be, yeah, it's not worth pursuing right now. The other thing too is, you know, kind of like what we said with NDAs, you know, NDAs are kind of like, you know, formality, but sometimes even just having that agreement, you know, is nice formality. And you know, sometimes you can just do a little, you know, saber rattling if somebody's not upholding their end, like, look, we've got an agreement, I could take it to court. You know, and so sometimes that will get people to be compliant, you know, even if they're, you know, being difficult otherwise. Or like Alonka says, you know, it's try negotiation. You know, right. if you know that, you know, it's gonna take you X amount of money and time and anguish and whatnot to get your money, you know, knock some money off, you get something out of it instead of nothing.
Yeah, it's nice to have the contracts, because the contracts are the stick and the settlement is the carrot. Right. So, you know, you try to find somewhere in the middle where you can beat him with the stick while he's eating the carrot. But what your question kind of asks is very, very broad too, because you're looking at a variety of different issues. One of the things about whether you can sue in small claims court or regular court, or what you have to do, or how much it's going to cost, how long it's going to take, really depends on what you're fighting over. There's a huge difference between a copyright dispute, which has to be taken only in federal court and it's going to be incredibly complicated, or somebody owes you, you know, in Georgia, we can go to magistrate court, small claims court, for less than $15,000. So if somebody owes you $12,000 for some code you wrote, that can be a very easy process. It can be very quick and very cheap. So you're always doing a cost-benefit analysis, but that cost-benefit analysis is going to change depending on the nature of your claim, the nature of the dispute, and the nature of the defendant, because whether you want to spend that $35,000 or not, you better make sure that the guy has money to pay you at the end of the day.
Right.
If the reason he didn't pay you the money to begin with is because he's broke, you really don't want to come give me a lot of money to chase him and say, well, but he's broke. Because the judgment's just paper, so it doesn't do you any good.
And I want to add a quick thing about paper, and this again ties into what was said back there, is some people believe in the paperless office. You know, I've got it in my Gmail archive. I can get it and print it anytime I want. But no, if it's any kind of a contract, anything with a signature, anything that is a legal document that you might have to produce in court, have a hard copy.
Yeah.
Have a hard copy. Maybe have two hard copies in different locations. So if one building burns down, you've got an offsite backup. But I'm a big believer in hard copies.
Yeah, I can't stress that we just had a week-long litigation over a case that probably would have resolved much, much faster, except that it was dealing with a company that had been out of business for 10 years and nobody had any of the records anymore. It was all in email. Yeah. And all those emails are gone. And, you know, what did the email say? Well, that's why we're litigating for 5 days, because no one can show me the email that says I win or I lose. And so if you have that contract, you have that paper, then it's a lot easier to come see me and get something done.
The person who has the contract has more power than the one who doesn't have the contract.
Does it have to be
Gotta wait for the gotta wait for the orange box.
Wait for the box.
Does it have to be original ink? Or on the paper, or it can be a PDF that's printed off.
You can do electronic signing these days. And you know, just print it off. You know, one of the first things I bought for my company, even though it was a while ago now, but you know, I bought a file cabinet. Even though I make electronic games, and we had, you know, we really didn't, you know, it was downloadable stuff. I wanted to have physical copies of the stuff. Exactly what Alonka and TJ said. You know, it's if you have that document, and you know. God forbid you lose access to your email or whatnot. Like, you know, the horror story back there. You lose Gmail access. All of a sudden, all those contracts are, you know, on Gmail servers, and you don't have easy access to them. What do you do then? Well, you know, that's a really tough situation you really don't want to be in.
Yeah. And even having them on Gmail servers, I've got so much mail. Sometimes even knowing the contract was there, I'm searching on their name, and I get 1,000 emails. Mm-hmm. And then I'm searching on the name, and was the word contract in the email or not? You know,
yep.
And it can take an hour to find it. You know, just put it in a manila folder that says contracts and know where that folder is. Much easier.
Other questions?
So we can also talk, I guess, about VC. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Also got game engines.
Hi. One of the things I've had in my own experience with having partners is that you don't always have to make them 50-50 partners.
Right.
And also, if you do plan to have an investor, an angel investor, or venture capital at some time, take the time to learn how they divide up your time. When you first get a partner, they want a much bigger piece of your pie. And as your company grows, that pie becomes smaller, but it's sort of like, you know, 100,000 times zero is zero. So you want to make sure that as you're dividing up your pie that you leave enough for you down the road. Mm-hmm. And ask your partner, like, how much of the administrative and development and marketing that they intend to do. Because if you have somebody who has a lot of alphabet, you know, but beyond their name, and they're not willing to get into the trenches with you, then they can have a big piece of your pie while you're doing all the actual work.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And these are really important aspects of owning the business. And you can feel kind of betrayed or disappointed down the road. You also need to ask them, what are they going to do about when you need to hire an attorney, since this keeps coming up, because that can be a $2,000 bill that they say, wait, you know, I didn't intend to pay that expense. So it's not just about profits, it's about expenses too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, one of the big benefits of, you know, just on a business level, one of the big benefits of mobile games is it does tend to have a very low overhead. You know, if you're starting out, you know, you probably don't have to worry about venture capitalists or investors or whatnot. You know, you can, you know, just do a simple LLC organization, get together some friends, throw something out there, see what sticks. That's great, you know. But yeah, once you get to the point, once you kind of have some experience, you're like, okay, I want to do this more seriously. I'm going to quit my day job. I'm going to, you know, focus on this. I'm going to look for investors. Absolutely, like she said, you know, make sure that, you know, you understand how the agreements are structured and, you know, like what, you know, again, this is where, you know, you talk to other people that have been down this road before. It's like, okay, how much of my company am I going to give away for the angels and how much am I going to have to give away for Series A or Series B? You know, understanding that, because, you know, what you don't want to do is you don't want to get down the road where it's like, well, okay, I gave away too big a piece of the pie at the beginning and now I need to raise more money, but we just have the small pie. So you either, you know, hope you can, you know, attract somebody for that small piece of pie, or you have to go back to your previous investor and say, look, I need to dilute you. Mm-hmm. And that's not an easy conversation to have with people because they're going to get very cranky about that.
Yeah. And to just maybe clarify for some of the people here that haven't, you know, looked at the pie slice thing, when we said 50-50 or 51-49, you're exactly right. It doesn't have to be. It could be that you start a company and you are 100% owner, and then anyone else that's involved, you just say, okay, well, I'm going to pay you so much money at such and such a time. Then I've seen many companies work that way if you have enough investment in order to pay them. And then we run into the whole issue of budgeting and knowing how much, it's called, how much runway do you have, you know, before your company has to be cash positive and it's bringing in money rather than just spending money on something. Being a 100% owner is a wonderful thing, because then if you do get an investor come in, investors often want to say, okay, I'm giving you this much money and you're going to give me a percentage of the company, 20% of the company, right, or whatnot. You negotiate that. Or maybe it's not a percentage deal. Maybe they say, okay, I'm going to invest in you and now I'm going to have a permanent seat on your board, but I want some sort of decision-making ability for your particular company. The investors want all kinds of different things. Generally, though, it's money for a percentage of the company.
We're going to be doing something with creative teams and royalties. So if you could address royalties, that would be wonderful. And I'm in the Atlanta area. We have a resource here called the Startup Lounge, and they have a huge library of podcasts that are really helpful, and okay, cocktail parties every quarter to meet venture capitalists if you've never been. Thank you.
So royalties.
Have the legal side first.
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously the legal side of royalties is I'm going to pay you a certain amount of money for every time I use your whatever. If it's I'm going to pay you a royalty for the character you created in my game or the code you provided for my game, rather than giving you ownership, rather than giving you a straight payment, I don't have to give you $50,000 for your product. I'm going to give you a 5% royalty every time the game is sold.
Like with multiplayer games, we had it where we had subscription revenue, and so it varied month by month, and customers were also doing specific purchases, like paying $200 because they wanted a cool wedding in this multiplayer game. And so we would look at the monthly revenue that the game made, and a certain percentage of that we would set aside and then divide that up among our contractors, and those were the royalties that they received.
So it's just another way of Well, it's a way of deferring payment. It's a way of making someone able to be paid without you having to come out of pocket now, so it gives you more runway, but it also gives the person who's created things the benefit that if your game takes off, then I'm gonna do really well, rather than you can afford to pay me $500 now, I'll take $500 now, and then I made $500. So there's benefits to both sides on a royalty.
On a practical level, however, though, once you start paying royalties, once you start doing royalty agreements, your bookkeeping and record keeping increases significantly, because there's probably almost certainly anybody who's smart is, you know, taking a royalty is going to want an audit provision, and you want to be able to, you know, open those books and close those books as fast as possible to, you know, not distract you from having to from your day-to-day business stuff. You know, I know a lot of people actually just don't even like to deal with royalties. They're like, you know, if I can't pay cash up front, I either do it myself or figure out how to do without. Just because, you know, it will significantly increase that record keeping you have to do.
So let's talk a little about venture capital. I mean, you were talking about go ahead about the different types of venture capital. You said a couple terms I didn't know. So
okay, yeah. So and to be clear, I mean, I've been involved with fundraising, but, you know, I never owned a company and did fundraising directly. But so when you start out, you know, generally you have your idea, you have your business formation. The first thing you're going to be looking for is angel capital.
Friends and family.
Yeah, well,
people who don't want anything back.
There's the three F's: friends, families, and fools. And so, you know, and generally this is like, you know, people that, you know really well that, you know, and your mom, like, oh, that's cute, you're starting a business. Here's $100 and some cookies. You know, just little things like, you know, so you can do, like, things so you can do, like, the formation of the company and whatnot. And it tends to be a little, like, you know, when you're dealing with friends and family, you know, it tends to be kind of a little fast and loose, you know, because, these, you know, kind of make it clear that, you know, you're not going to be part of the company. You know, I'm not going to hire you. You know, you might lose your money. But then you start getting to more organized things like angel investment. And so these were, you know, these are basically people that, you know, have significant wealth, probably, you know, raised from, you know, their own businesses. And they're like kind of looking for other businesses they want to kind of give a leg up. And this tends to be a lot more formal. One of the best places to do this is AngelList. It's a site called AngelList. It's basically like, you know, you describe your company, and then basically you can look at lists of angel investors, talk to them. It's a great way to network too. You know, but you might find some people are kind of interested in, and angels tend to kind of be very small, and, you know, they might want specific things. They might want a, you know, a small slice of the company to start off with or whatnot. But it's going to be, you know, kind of generally low amounts, you know, like 5,000, 10,000, you know, again, just enough to get you kind of, you know, where you need to go to get, you know, your initial versions out.
I like to put myself in the frame of mind of I've made like $100 million, right, and now I get to go and help other companies, and I'm not really going to ask for anything from them. I'm just going to say, okay, I like your idea, or I like you. I like the color of your eyes.
Right.
And here's 5,000, 10,000, 50,000. Could be more. It really depends on the investor.
Right. I have amazing eyes. If you have.
But then after that, then after you kind of get your prototype, you know, then you kind of start shopping around to the larger venture capital firms. And that's where you get into the different series, you know, Series A, Series B, and these tend to be super formal. You know, they are, you know, like Alonka said before, they are like, you know, we want X percent of your company. Here's the amount of money we do. You have to worry a lot more about valuation.
And what's the exit strategy?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And yeah, once you kind of get to that series, you know, Series A and Series B, those investors want a return on investment. They're like, you know, okay, you know, when are you, you know, I want to see 10 times my money back in, you know, X months or years or whatever. You know, what's your strategy to get there? You know, either, you know, acquisition, public offering, you know, getting sold, you know, to, or, you know, merging with another company where they get stock or whatnot.
Having a great product that makes a ton of money.
Yeah, right. You know, or, right. Yeah, just, you know, you buy them back out if you have a big company.
And they know it's a high risk investment. They know that they could put in $2 million and never see anything back.
Right.
But they also want to know that there's a possibility that they're going to put in $2 million and get out $3 million, or $2 million and get out $10 million. Something that's going to be a better return than they would get in a bank.
Right. One thing, going back to the angel investor level two that I forgot to mention, it's very, very important. There's this concept called an accredited investor. If you start giving out chunks of your company, unless you want to go through a lengthy, painful audit process, you generally want to look for accredited investors. And this is what's nice about AngelList, is basically, you know, you will find savvy investors that will know if they're accredited or not. Accredited is, I think the current rules is like they have to have income of $200,000 a year or $1 million in assets. Again, you know, just look up the term accredited investor, find out about this. If you're not dealing with accredited investors and you give them chunks of the company, like I said, you know, you have to go through kind of an audit process that tends to be kind of lengthy and expensive. Finding accredited investors, in theory, they're savvy enough. They know that, you know, this is a, you know, risky investment. You know, they might lose their money. So you have to, it's a lot less stringent of what you have to go through in order to appeal to them. But yeah, like, you know, that, and that's like, you know, if you're giving equity in your company for those investors.
One thing that you need to do on those, any of those deals, though, maybe not your mom's cookies, but everything else above that. And I know it sounds like the broken record, the lawyer's going to say paper again, but you need to get some paper. And it's not even in this instance that you guys need to make sure that you've documented the loan, because I guarantee you the guy giving you that much money is going to hand you some paper, and he's going to want you to sign it. What you need to do there is not worry so much about going and making sure you've got a good contract, but making sure that they're giving you a good contract, because you don't want to get in there and say, I'm going to give you $100,000. I'm going to give you $100 million. You're going to sign this right here. Because what are you signing? What are you signing away? There are lots of things that can be buried in legalese that mean something that you don't expect. And quite frankly, can be very, very harmful to your ownership position or your equity interests down the line. So I'm not saying these people are out to screw you. Obviously, they're not. They're giving you money. They're trying to do the right thing. They recognize the risk. They want to take advantage. They want to get a good return on their investment. But a lot of times, they don't even know what their contracts say. They had some attorney draft them up, and they don't really understand. So you need to make sure that you take that contract to somebody who knows what it means before you sign it. The reason for that is you can read it, and you can think you know what it means. But what it means to you and what it means to me might be two very different things.
And what it means to a judge is presiding over the right. case, too.
What it means to a judge is something very different than a common sense meaning. The best example of this is best efforts. If you have a legal contract and it says you're going to use best efforts to get something done, well, that doesn't sound too bad. Of course I'm going to try my best. I'm always going to try my best. I'm a doer. But what best efforts means is not you tried really hard, good job, pat on the head. What best efforts means is you will do whatever it takes within your legal power to acquire that end. If I say that you're going to deliver this to me by 3 o'clock today, and you don't have the manpower to get it done, your job is to go hire the manpower to do it. That's your best efforts. If you're 15 minutes away and it's 10 minutes to the deadline, your job is to run over your grandma to get over here, because that's what best efforts means to a lawyer, to a judge. What best efforts means to the guy reading a contract isn't that. And there's a lot of terms of art like that that mean something very, very different than you might understand them to mean in a common sense reading of the contract. So really have those things looked at.
And one other step, and it's kind of between that you've decided that you're going to seek venture capital and before getting these contracts, is you want to create something called a pitch deck, which is generally going to be a PowerPoint slide presentation. But even though it's a series of slides, it's called a deck. And it's going to be your sales pitch, why venture capital would want to invest in you. And a common mistake with pitch decks is to make it sort of like a book report and say, this is what we do and this is what we think we can do. And it's not, it's a sales pitch. And you want to put in there something very quick, very brief, something that someone who's not in the mobile development industry is going to be able to understand, saying how much money that you're looking for, what kind of return you're going to get. Very important is who are the key people that are involved with this company. Because often investors are going to invest not in the idea, they're going to invest in the team that is implementing that idea. Because if you have the right team, they're going to deliver no matter what the idea is. So being able to say that you have a team that has made money before, a team that has lots of letters after their names, MBA, PMP, these kinds of things, investors like those kinds of things. They like to see that this is an experienced team that can work as a team in order to get things done. And then also have some basic things with numbers, saying the actual product that you're doing, you may be all excited, oh, it's going to be a mobile game, and it's going to have tiles over here, and there's going to be characters running over here. Investor won't care about that at all. They just want to know it's a game, this is the genre of it, this is the size of the audience, this is the expected earnings of it. That's the kind of thing that needs to be in a pitch deck.
Yeah, and, you know, like Alana said, it's a sales deck, so, you know, it's a sales pitch. So, you know, you want to get them excited as soon as possible.
Right.
You know, maybe show them some awesome concept art, or, you know, or
yeah,
you know,
art's good.
Talk about, you know, like, oh, hey, you know, we want to make a game like this other game that's sold, you know, 10 billion mm-hmm. copies or whatever. And then, yeah, definitely highlight the team. You know, your team is your greatest asset. I mean, really, ideas are cheap. But if you can get together a great team, that's your biggest asset at the beginning, because these are the people that, you know, you've convinced that are dedicated to, you know, the cause. So, you know, this is exactly what the investor is going to be looking at, like, can this team deliver? And then do facts and figures, but a lot of times this will be kind of the supplemental stuff, like, you know, say, you know, give the highlights, like, okay, our budget's going to be, you know, we're going to take this type, you know, we're going to take, you know, 12 months to do, and we need, you know, $1 million to do it, and then we're looking at sales estimates of, you know, $10 million over the first, you know, 6 months, trailing off to whatever, you know, and you know, get, I mean, you don't have to be 100% accurate, but, you know, get some numbers to back up your bullshit, basically.
Right.
You know, so that, you know, like, you know, say, oh, you know, look at other games in the same genre, same type, same, you know, whatever, you know, something that looks similar enough to your game, that, you know, usually kind of gameplay genre, say, this is how it sold, this is the trajectory, so based on this, we think that our trajectory is going to be like this, but we think our quality is going to be better, so we're going to be, you know, do twice as much or whatever.
Yeah, based on our market research, we believe that we will be capturing this segment of the marketplace.
And the wonderful thing about mobile stuff is, you know, there's a lot of data out there. Like, there's, you know, this is, you know, mobile games came around a lot about the time that a lot of data mining came around. You know, sure, you might have to lay out a little bit of money maybe to get some, you know, the more detailed figures, but, you know, there's a lot of sites out there, App Annie and whatnot, you know, where you can find out information about exactly, you know, what position these games are, you know, were in the App Store, and, you know, what their trajectory was, you know, where they maintained and where they fell off, and if they were able to come back. And you can look, you know, you can look at that, you know, that history and say, okay, well, they fell off here, and that's, you know, you can look at the company history, and, okay, this probably happened, but then they took out a Super Bowl ad or whatever, and then their sales shot back up. You know, it, and like I said, sometimes not even that information is not necessarily useful, but showing that you did the whole work to get that information,
right,
you know, can be impressive, because, again, that shows to the investor that, you know, you're serious about this. You're looking at this as a business, not just as, hey, I'm making a game, isn't that cool?
Give me $2 million, right? And I'm sure it's going to make money, because it has to.
Right, exactly.
It has to.
It's going to be awesome. So you have dinosaurs?
Wait a minute. Are you suggesting there are businesses that don't make money?
And with the pitch deck, there's two different ways it's going to be delivered. One is you're going to be there in front of the investor, slides next to you, and you're going to be like going through the slides and also being the salesperson. You want to rehearse that before you go to the investor. Go to some of your advisors. Go to the Entrepreneur Center and say, can I practice my pitch deck? And they're going to give you some amazing advice. But sometimes you're going to run into an investor who just says, send me the pitch deck. And you're not going to be able to be there to explain the slides. So you want a pitch deck that someone can look at without you there, and it can still do the sales job for you.
And I mean, the big thing, you know, like Alanka said, is that, you know, different investors are going to want different things. And one of the big things too is, like, you know, one of the hardest things if you're going to do venture, you know, if you're going to raise venture funding, is, you know, cold calling investors. They really don't like that. they you know, a lot of them will just basically screen calls, and, like, you know, if they don't have an introduction to you from somewhere else. And again, this is where the networking comes in, because, you know, if you're working with somebody else that, you know, did some other business stuff, but they know some venture, you know, venture capitalists, then you can get an introduction, and that helps a lot, because then you have a warm introduction instead of trying to cold call them.
And if it is a big venture capital company that will accept cold calls, do your research beforehand. Go to their website and look at what kinds of things they want to invest in.
Pretend it's a job interview, really. Like, you know, pretend you're applying for a job, and the job is you get $2 million to make your game, or, you know, whatever your budget is. Do your research like you know, this is the most important job in the world, because, again, that shows some dedication, that shows some follow through, and that's going to be very important.
And often these venture capital companies, they're not investing in just games. They're investing in oil industry, and they're investing in some potato chips and things, and they may want to have a varied portfolio of what they're investing in, and they're not investing in a mobile game at the moment. So they may say, we're interested in investing in mobile games or mobile apps. Go to their website. They've probably got it on a cycle, like they're going to be reviewing pitches once a quarter or twice a year. So, and they'll say, pitches should be submitted by September 30th. Do that. Don't submit it in April, because it's just going to go right into the bid bucket. They're not even going to take a look at it. But if you can figure out what their cycle is, and it's usually plainly printed on their website, must be submitted by September 30th, must have a cover letter, must have no more than 10 slides, boom, 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 and just follow their instructions, and that'll increase the possibility that they'll look at it.
And not to be the wet blanket, keep in mind that if you're going to go for venture investment, they don't invest in games, individual games. You might have the best idea for a game ever. They don't care. They're going to look to invest in companies. And, you know, even if your company, you know, and I mean, one of the realities is, you know, especially for mobile games, you know, it has this in spades. It's a really a hit-driven industry. I mean, you can make a wonderful game. It gets out there. It just doesn't find its audience, and it dies. So what you really want to do is you want to say, okay, how do I stand out from the rest of it? You know, one of the big ways in the past was to say, okay, well, I'm not just making a game, I'm making a platform. I'm developing a certain base that I can build off of, you know, that has, you know, billing and, you know, all this other stuff in it. And, you know, maybe I can become a publisher for other companies too, where, you know, other developers will come to me, I take a 30% cut, you know, on top of, you know, the app store taking their 30% cut. But, you know, I handle all this other stuff, because and this initial game is going to be the proof of concept for that. You know, you really need to look at that. You know, like, you know, again, you know, a lot of these investors are not going to be gamers, are not going to be excited about your, you know, awesome new, you know, turn-based strategy role-playing game. I will love it to death, but, you know, the investors are like, you know, I don't see, you know, I don't have enough context to understand how this is going to make money. But, you know, if you have a larger kind of plan for your business, like, you know, I want to grow it into this way, or, you know, we're going to create this basis where, you know, we're going to be able to, you know, put out 12 games in 6 months' time with a group of five people because we have this base, that's going to be potentially more interesting to them.
And I just wanted to talk briefly about technology. Those of you, some of you have done what's called native development. So you're creating for iPhones, iOS. That requires a language called Objective-C when you're making something for iOS, or you're making something for Android, which requires an entirely different language, which is Java. So you can make a really cool game for the Android, and you think, oh, I want to port it over to iOS, and then you realize you got to learn a whole different programming language, Objective-C, which kind of sucks. Or you can use what's called a cross-platform engine, where you write in one language, and then it forks it, and it exports in what's called the native code to the iOS and the Android. But there's lots of different cross-platform engines out there. Now, Unity is a big cross-platform engine. Every engine is going to have its pluses and minuses. It's something you're going to want to take a look at. Unity, you generally are going to write in C#. A Unity with QA, sometimes it's a little difficult to see what your app or what your game is going to look like on an iOS device or on an Android device. Sometimes it'll just create a little box on the screen so you see the size, but it's not running it in what's called native format. So there's a whole bunch of bugs that won't show up until you actually port it to that device. There is a Corona is something, but then you need to know a language called Lua and then port it. There's also engines that will use JavaScript. So small plug for my company, we have an engine called Platino, where you write once in JavaScript and then port to iOS and Android. So you want to research what it is you want to do. Do you want to have games that are going to be running on both platforms? Also, some of you, I'm sure many of you already know this, when you're creating a game for iOS, you've got a limited number of devices that it's going to show up on. It's going to be the iPod, it's going to be an iPhone, it's going to be an iPad. It's going to be a known number of devices. When you're creating for Android, you suddenly got 200 different kinds of devices. And a game that runs really well on a high-end Android device isn't going to run at all on a low-end Android device. And this has been a headache for many, many Android developers, which is why I said you have my sympathies. When you're doing QA, you're probably like, well, it works great on this one, but it doesn't work at all on this one, or the characters run off the screen on this device. And so QA becomes, quality assurance becomes much, much more of a headache.
No, I absolutely agree. And, you know, really, if this is, you know, if you're looking at your first project, or, you know, even, you know, one of your first few projects, limiting your scope is probably one of the best things you can do. Like, you know, I deal with a lot of indie developers, you know, mobile, online, whatever. And one of the biggest problems they run into is they scope creep. You know, they want to bite off more than they can chew. You know, the classic example I had to deal with a lot is like, you know, the group of, you know, three guys with no industry experience, like, yeah, we're going to make a World of Warcraft clone. I'm like, good luck with that. That's not going to happen. But, you know, if you want to make something smaller, and you know, like, so if you want to do devices, if you have a Mac, you know, hey, you know, develop for the iPhone. That's probably, you know, going to be a lot less, you know, headaches dealing with a platform specifically. But, you know, maybe, you know, or, you know, develop for, you know, high-end Android devices. Trying to do it all first thing, you're going to be spending a whole lot more time. You know, get your process down first, and then expand from that.
I think we have time for one more question.
Any questions?
Yes, Ms. Dunnan, is it worth doing the Android for your first iteration of a game?
I would say iOS for the first iteration, simply because you've got that smaller subset of devices, so it's going to be much easier to kind of check quality. Then again, pluses and minuses, you have to go through the Apple Store, which is a little more difficult than going through the Google Play Store. So it kind of depends where
your strengths are. And the flip side, too, I mean, it depends on if you know, if you use Windows machine. Like, I'm a Windows developer in my day job. I don't use Apple products. I have an Android phone. So, you know, in my case, you know, I already have a platform to develop on. I can get tools for free. You know, as Alonka just said, it's easier to get into the Google Play Store or even the Amazon App Store. So that might make more sense for me, even though iOS may be a little easier to develop on. I don't have the tools for it. I can pick up and go easier on Android. It really depends on your specific situation of the developers.
Yeah, and intellectual property. If you're concerned about protecting your intellectual property, I would go with Apple, which has more aggressive policies than Google Play. If you want something that's going to be shipping very quickly, use Google Play. If you're interested about market penetration, I think it's 60% of people own Androids and 40% own iOS devices right now.
Okay. So if someone says to me, iOS 9 has a great conversion tool that's yet to be proven at this point.
I mean, what do you tend to develop on? Are you developing on a Windows computer or on a Mac?
I don't do any of it. I do the business side. Okay. So,
I would ask developers.
Yeah, talk to your tech geeks. Yeah. I mean, they'll say, like, you know, are you a Windows developer or are you an Apple developer?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, that's the fundamental question, and then a lot of that will determine what you do afterwards.
Yeah. If they're all working on Macs and you say, oh no, I want us to develop for Android, you're going to need to buy a bunch of Windows computers for them. So that's going to be an extra cost. But find out what they're using.
So I think that's it.
Any other?
Yes.
Yep. We're
dead
on.
Okay.
Yeah, dead on.
So
I like
all right.
That.
All good right. Questions.
Yeah. Good
Thank
questions.
You.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Buy their games.